Let me turn it over to Michaela Engert, who is a city planner for the city of Keene. So she's in a great position to give you some of their experience from the local government level of adaptation planning. This is Keene, New Hampshire. She's been working on their climate action planning process and is also the project manager for the community's master plan update process, which is underway right now. And both her education and professional experience, she's really focused on sustainability issues that cover everything from food security to energy and a very important aspect, which I know some of you have some questions about, which is the collaborative community participation process that is a critical part of adaptation planning. So, Michaela, I'll turn it over to you, and I think we have your slides ready to go.
All righty. Hopefully everyone can hear me. Hi, everyone. My name is Michaela Engert, and I work for the City of Keene as a city planner. And I'm here to talk a little bit about our process today. I've got a lot to say. I've got a lot of slides, so I'm going to move quickly as I possibly can, and hopefully we'll have some time left at the end to take some questions. Let's see here. Is it not moving for you guys? Is it moving for me? It's moving for me, but not for you. Okay, there we go. Yay. Where are we? Who are we? What are we doing? This is kind of what I hope to give you a background on, a little bit about what we've done, both mitigation side and adaptation side, talking about what we're doing to make it stick, to make it normal, make it real, make it habitual, that sort of thing, and then also give you a little bit of background on is it working, what worked for us, what challenges we might have faced, that sort of thing, just some general advice. All righty. So, where are we? Just in case if you don't know, we're a tiny little community in the southwest corner of the state of New Hampshire. We have a population of just under 25,000. We are pretty much a strong council, weak mayor, city manager form of government. We have 15 city councilors, which is quite a number for a community of our size. A lot of people go, wow, when I say that. And we've actually been working on the issue of climate change since even earlier than 1999, I would say the early 1990s, but officially in 1999-2000. And that was when we joined ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability. We became one of the first communities in New Hampshire actually to take up the topic of climate change, to develop a climate change action plan, set greenhouse gas emission reduction targets, and do that sort of thing. And we have a Cities for Climate Protection Committee. We borrowed the name from ICLEI's CCP program. And that group is really the oversight group for what is now being called our climate plan, and that includes both mitigation and adaptation. So here's another theme, right? You've already heard in the previous two presentations a lot about mitigation and adaptation, aligning them, putting them together, mainstreaming them, that sort of thing. But we've also heard about the recommendation to have some sort of oversight committee to keep things moving. And that's what our CCP committee provides for us. And just to give you an idea, we've done a lot of projects. You're going to see a few more slides that highlight some of those projects. But we've got 33 that have been implemented to date. And we've got, another 40 that are either being assessed for feasibility or are in progress right now. So that's huge. We're also in the process of taking a look at our greenhouse gas emission numbers again to provide an update, measure our success. Where are we in terms of hitting our reduction goals? And we also want to be able to step back and renew focus, identify new projects, maybe set new targets that align more closely with the Kyoto Protocol, that sort of thing. And as a result of all this mitigation work, and the reason why I'm focusing so much on this, some of you are going, what is she talking about? Why is she totally focused on the mitigation stuff? Well, there's a reason. Because of the success that we've seen in the mitigation side of things, and also combined with the fact that we were heavily impacted in 2005 by a major flood event here in Keene, ICLEI approached us to become one of, their first pilot communities to go through an adaptation planning exercise through their Climate Resilient Communities program. And really, the take-home point from a lot of this is that the work that we've been doing on climate change over the last decade or so really goes to the conversation that we've been having at the community level and how it's evolved over time, how it started out maybe talking about climate change, or how it started out talking about economics and saving a penny or two or three or maybe a couple hundred, and into a much larger conversation about community sustainability. And also I'm going to highlight a little bit, too, about the connection between that work and then our master plan. Let's see here. So why should we respond? Four things. You guys probably already know this, so I'll hit this really quickly. It's definitely in our best economic interest, right? We all have budgets that we need to, I guess, account for. We need to justify in some way why are we spending money the way that we're spending money. And particularly now, given the political environment that we're all operating in, there's a big old spotlight on this. I don't know about you guys, but we get questions daily about this, especially since we're starting our capital improvement program update. We know the details of what's happening on the ground. We know what's happening. We know what our community needs. We know, you know, what's in their best interest, that sort of thing. We can also respond quicker. We are the first responder. You know, regardless if it's a federal or a state program or even a local program, we're going to hear about it first, whether it's working, whether it's not, that sort of a thing. And then also, you know, we're positioned to meet the needs better. We've got local experts. We've got information. We've got flexibility and capacity, as well as motivation, you know, to address a lot of these issues that perhaps larger forms of government cannot do. And I'm not saying, you know, that other levels of government shouldn't act. You know, they should. But as you've probably even read in a lot of the papers lately, given what's going on in Cancun, local government really has a very, very large role to play in a lot of this work. So how we got started. As I mentioned, we joined ICLEI. We created a CCP committee. We did our inventory stuff. And we adopted our climate change action plan in 2004. And we established an initial reduction target of 10% below our 1990 level. And so that sets the basis for the conversation. Here's, in general, just our reduction target. So you can see we have two. We have a community side target as well as a municipal side target. You can see the numbers of what we need to achieve in order to reach those by 2015. It's a pretty big, I guess it's a tall order, you could say. Some of the measures that we've done to date. Biodiesel, methane to energy at our waste facility, microhydro installation, recycling programs. A lot of these, you'll recognize, they seem pretty simple. They're low-hanging fruit, and that's exactly it. They are low-hanging fruit. They gave us easy wins. Energy upgrades, those kinds of things, putting some of our police on bicycles. We've also done a lot of bigger, more programmatic things, providing tax breaks for folks, putting in roundabouts. You know, that's the transportation side sort of a measure that gets that, you know, reducing idling time. Doing a public education campaign around idling. There's something that I don't know if it was noted earlier, but the 10% challenge program for small businesses to encourage them to reduce their emissions and save money at the same time. So we've been doing a lot of different mitigation side things, and it's working. We're seeing savings. We're seeing, you know, these things become institutionalized within our organization and also within our community. And this is just an example of some of the stuff that we're seeing. And this is some of the stuff that's coming up that's in the pipeline, so even bigger programs and projects that will address mitigation side things. But as you notice, some of you are probably going, well, that's a mitigation side strategy, but again, it also might have an adaptive component to it. So we might be able to kill, you know, a couple of birds with one really big rock, I guess you could say. So codes, you know, how can we do that? How can we make buildings more energy efficient as well as make them more capable to handle changes in precipitation, snow load, that sort of thing? And now to get finally to the CRC stuff, and many of you are probably going, ooh, about time she got to the to the climate adaptation piece of it. So, again, just to reiterate, we were asked to test this program as part of the ICLEI's you know, their new climate resilient communities effort, and that was sponsored through NOAA. And really what this does is it complements the CCP program. And again, just to hit on top of that, note that climate mitigation and climate adaptation, they're really sister strategies. And our approach has been now to really combine that conversation within the community. And ultimately, of course, the goal of that program specifically is to improve long-term resiliency. So how did we go about it? What did we do? Again, to reiterate some of the stuff that Terry had said, we went through a process where we did a little bit of resiliency study. We looked at our vulnerabilities and our opportunities and created goals and ways to achieve those goals. Most of the effort went into actually that creation of the plan. We created a committee. They were made up of all of our department heads, and they really spent quite a bit of time together, over 6 to 8 meetings max. I think it was 8 meetings max that we had. They either met for a half a day or a full day. Large community stakeholders were also involved. And there was a lot of background planning that went into it by myself, equally staff, and an intern that we had hired, so that when we got those folks into the room, because they were so incredibly busy, you know, they're being pulled in a million different directions all the time, we wanted to make sure that we used their time effectively and efficiently and that we achieved what we needed to achieve to make sure that the process was moving forward. They did go through a ranking process to assign priorities to different sectors. That was difficult. Let me tell you just about how incredibly cerebral that whole entire process was. It was, some days you could just see it on people. They would get a little bit bogged down and I don't know if depressed is the right word, but maybe discouraged is the right word. Just because when you start talking about adaptation, you start seeing how everything connects. And if you, you know, push a little bit over here on one side, it kind of, you know, maybe comes out, you know, somewhere else in a different spot. So it can be a very difficult kind of conversation to have, especially when you're trying to deal with things with imperfect information or knowledge, or perhaps, you know, a lower level or amount of information than you're typically used to operating in. Because remember, this is dealing with future states, things that, you know, we're not looking back, right? We're not able to hang our hat on it as easily, so to speak. So we did go through that entire process as well, and that was a little bit difficult. But I'll tell you, the light bulb for me was when our chief of police turned around one day and we were asking the question, you know, you know, in your role, what kinds of things are you going to have to think about based on a certain impact? And we were talking about high heat index days. And my chief of police turned to me and said, you know what? He's like, Michaela, what do people do when it gets really hot out? And I, you know, I'm stumped. I'm a planner. I don't know what people do when it gets really hot. You go swimming, you know, that seems to be natural to me. But I wasn't thinking of it through his lens, right, as a chief of police. And he said, no, Michaela, he's like, people go out and they drink more. And I'm like, yeah, so what are you saying? Well, for him, what that means is that he has to pay attention to the number of people that he has out in a beat, the number of beats that he's got out, what kind of patrol resources he's going to need in terms of equipment. Because generally when people drink more, they tend to be a little bit more rowdy, and I guess that ups the number of instances that they end up seeing. So it was those kinds of, like, little bits and pieces and moments, those light bulbs kind of going off when folks were getting it that were really, really, really valuable to our process. Okay, some of our climate impacts. Here's some of the impacts that we're expecting. As I mentioned earlier, we have a history of flooding. You know, we're located in a lake bed, and pretty much, I would say almost half of our community is located in a 500-year storm classification currently. So, you know, that's a really big thing for us, and again, that's what spurred this whole planning effort. Changes in snowfall patterns, heavier, wetter snow, more ice, bigger storms, that sort of thing. And then, you know, what does it mean, too, in terms of changes in plant and animal species? You know, we identify a lot with the sugar maple up here from a natural heritage perspective and a tourist perspective. What does that mean for us if, you know, we see that species migration? You know, more dynamic weather patterns, air quality. We're also in the valley. I mean, how do we deal with that as we move forward? And, you know, what can we expect? What kind of opportunities and vulnerabilities? Here's a good example of someone had asked earlier about one of the charts, a matrix to take a look at how to assess your vulnerabilities. This is generally for a qualitative assessment, and that's kind of what we did. We didn't have a lot of hard numbers available. We used Union Concerned Scientists information from NOAA. We tried to boil it down as best as we could to our I guess, regional area. So we could get down to the state of New Hampshire, what we expect. We could get down to roughly southern New Hampshire. But then we kind of had to take that information and mesh it with what we were seeing, what we were observing. So, you know, anecdotally, that kind of a thing. But this is just giving you an example of, you know, what it's like to begin to deal with a certain level of uncertainty and how to assess your possibility of impact. And, you know, I guess we're pretty lucky up here that we're a smaller region. So dealing with the kind of information that we had was okay for us. We were comfortable, you know, not having it downscaled to the point where it's right in our own backyard. Other communities might find that to be a little bit daunting, but you also may have different resources available to you as well. So keep plugging away at trying to find those resources when you can. Here's where we have opportunity in our built environment. Again, we built it down or we created three different sectors, the built environment, the natural environment, and the social environment. And these were the major themes that we had identified. Again, a lot of this stuff, if you're a planner or you're working in community development, you know, this stuff makes sense, right? You talk about this anyway going through your planning exercises. Specifically, I wanted to highlight something that we're dealing with right now, and that's assessing our culverts, again, because flooding is such an issue and is an impact and will continue to be an impact for us into the future. We've had some work done by local university students to actually assess one of our watersheds and let us know how our culverts are doing. Now, of course, this is valuable in terms of doing a capital improvement program update or any kinds of changes. However, what we recognize in value, and our DPW director recognizes the value of this as well, it's not enough just to look at one watershed, because making changes in infrastructure within the watershed, yes, might be able to move water from point A to point B better, but what happens upstream? Outside of our geopolitical boundaries, and then what also happens downstream. So we're trying to balance all of this, all of these different considerations as we move forward and make some of these infrastructure upgrades as well on a much larger, more regional scale. Again, some of our opportunities in the natural environment that we have, a lot of this, it can easily align with a lot of the other things that we're already doing in terms of policy or legislation or planning or projects, that sort of thing. And finally, the social environment. And an interesting thing that came up out of this actually was the focus on food security issues. That was something that typically a lot of communities end up not highlighting quite a bit, or even understanding really what it means to have a food secure community. So that was impressive to me, that people were already picking up on the value of local food and local producers as we went through the exercise. So where are we at with resiliency today in Keene? And again, I apologize, I'm totally broad brushing this stuff and throwing a lot of information at you. So please ask lots and lots of questions later on. Hopefully we can clarify. We're moving forward with making changes to our standards, taking a look at where we should build, where we shouldn't build, you know, creating greenways or places for animals as well as people to be able to move, have those connections. Looking at reliability of emergency communications, that's another thing. With switch over from landline to cell line, that's a real vulnerability. How do you get information out to people if the quote-unquote traditional way of communicating, a majority of people no longer have? And if the new system is reliant upon energy systems that could be knocked down by ice storms, you know, your power systems could go down, then that causes those new communication systems to fail. So how do we think about that? How can we increase our resiliency and our reliability in those systems? CRC today, again, how are we getting this back into our master plan effort or moving forward with it, right? How are we implementing this? How do we know that this is happening and working well? We're seeing it in a lot of the projects that we're moving forward. Trying to identify measures is really difficult, but the good news is that we just finished our master planning effort. And as Terry highlighted, that's really where the rubber is going to hit the road. And we're going to continue to tackle a lot of the easy things first, the things that we can do today, the things that we perhaps already have in the pipeline, but we just have to apply the climate question to it, add that on as part of the criteria for infrastructure assessment, that sort of thing. Or changes in code. So we're really trying to continue with our strategy of going after the easy stuff first, because then it also continues to build upon success, It motivates people. It keeps the conversation relevant. And we can also tie it into different conversations, too, that people might be having, whether they're interested in bicycle pedestrian pathways or if it's in land preservation or if they're really gung-ho about being, you know, a climate change boss. You know, that's cool, too. Whatever their conversation is, that's how we got to tap it, or tap into what they can relate to. So the master plan part of things. Our master plan was just adopted in September, unanimously by both Planning Board and Council, which was huge. As I mentioned earlier, it was written through the filter of a changing climate. Again, our conversation around climate change has evolved over the last decade. And in particular, our adaptation planning process really spurred the emphasis and the focus into our comprehensive master planning process. The master plan process followed the adaptation process. And what we're going to end up doing with this is really starting to align what we're doing as an organization and also what our community stakeholders and other community organizations are doing. We're going to try and create a framework around that. We're just starting the implementation side of things. What's really impressive is that we had over 2,000 people from our community participate in this, and community means Vermont, Massachusetts, as well as the greater Monadnock region and City of Keene. And that's a huge thing for us. We created new leadership. We created new models for participation. We used various media outlets, social utilities, guerrilla marketing tactics, you name it, we went after it. We went out to the people. We didn't expect the people to come to us. And that perhaps was the greatest thing that we could have done. And I would recommend that regardless of what kind of planning program that you're doing, that you really take that kind of open book approach towards how you design your outreach programs and really think about who it is that you need to get at the table. And then identify the people that you normally wouldn't see at the table, or at least brainstorm that so that you can identify gaps in some of the participation that you have. So really, you know, the emphasis take-home point on this is that getting to the point where we're integrating and aligning a lot of this into the guiding document for our community, it wasn't like flipping a light switch. It's nothing that we could do overnight. It's a conversation. That conversation continues to evolve, and you have to continually look in your toolbox and see what you have available to you and get creative with it. How can you use those tools in a different way? So now, as we move forward, we needed a place to start, and again, it gets back to that toolbox thing. What are we doing? How are we doing this? We're going to take a look at the stuff that we have. We're going to look at our regulations. What are the opportunities in that? What's happening in our transportation network? What's happening in our neighborhood planning? What's happening in terms of an opportunity to make our buildings better, you know, how do we handle stormwater, that kind of a thing. How are we going to end up using this whole entire plan really, I guess, internally? That's stuck, isn't it? It is stuck. Okay, there we go. And create some sort of implementation plan that really melds together in some sort of fashion, both sides of the Oreo cookie, the community side and then the city government side of things. So this is a little process, and I'm going to blow your minds right now with a really crazy diagram that we call alignment. And this is an example of really what we're trying to do here. We have a two-step budgeting process. We have a six-year capital improvement program for where larger investments are scheduled and prioritized. The second step is an operating budget. And really what we're trying to do is assess what we're doing. Are we doing the right things? Are we doing the things that the community wants us to do, that sort of thing? And the inner circle there, that white one, that one represents the six vision focus areas out of our 2008 community vision. And the yellow circle shows the master plan and its more specific level of detail and really kind of all the different areas that tie into that. So what we're trying to do, and our CFO is really taking an initiative on this, we're trying to make it so that when folks end up submitting projects for their CIP program, and I'll show you the next slide here. Oh, that shows the feedback loop. Here's an example. If you've got like binoculars, you could probably see this and read it a little bit closer. The way that people are using this is that there's areas for alignment underneath that project rationale. They have to basically link it into the master plan and then state in the project description how it links into that goal. And that's just one way that we're starting to go about making this more automatic. It might not be incredibly robust at this point, but we recognize that we need to take small steps because we need to get the process right in terms of how we integrate all of this and continually assess that. And, again, we're creating another group of folks that can provide some oversight to all of this and, you know, let us know whether we're moving forward or not. So real quickly, some observations. Leadership, education, keep talking about it, integration, and include everybody and everybody. These are some of the things you hear time and time and time and time again. You got to have someone who's going to, you know, wave a flag. You got to be able to let people, you know, come to their own conclusions. So putting a lot of times information out there, you're not necessarily trying to convince them one way or the other, but just give them the right information, which ties right into talking about it. And then the integration of decision-making and making sure that you have all of your departments talking about it and understanding it is incredibly key. And then consistently what has worked for us time and time again is making economic arguments. This appeals to our practical side of things, just as human beings in general. So that's been a real success for us, and I would recommend that others keep moving with that as well. Use your new tools, as I mentioned earlier. Partner with anybody that you can. Create those collaborations. Recognize that we're all, you know, working within incredibly limited resources these days, and even more so as we move into the future. And how can we best use those resources? How can we best, you know, work with one another to move forward and achieve community-wide goals to the best of our ability without getting crosswise? We need to dedicate staff time. There's just got to be time for it. Someone has to do it. Someone has to bird dog it. Someone has to watch it. Again, education, get speaker series out there. Sometimes we're a little bit too close to it. So if, you know, I go in as a planner to city council and I say something, they won't hear it. But if I bring in somebody who is, 50, 60 miles or so away, you know, 100 miles away, say I bring in someone from Boston, all of a sudden they're the expert. They could literally say the same sentence, but because it's not coming from me, for some reason, it's just the way that we work as human beings. We tend to hear things from different people at different times. And pushing higher levels of government to act is another thing. We can only take this so far, right? We're local government. We're going to hit a ceiling at some point, especially as a Dillon's rural state, where we need our state to step up and provide some of the support and policy that we need, as well as some of the funding. And, of course, the same thing with our federal government. And I'm happy to say that we're seeing this change. It might not be fast enough for some of us, but it is happening, and that's encouraging. Is it working? I can't tell you yet. We still have to measure. I will tell you, though, that based on some of the numbers that we've gotten back in terms of our GHG stuff, we're behind the ball on that. In terms of adaptation, we're trying to figure out how we're going to measure it with any kind of number associated with it. And we're taking a look at sustainability indicators as well to see if that's something that can help us. Again, we are a smaller community, so, you know, we don't have the same kinds of resources available to us that, you know, say New York or Chicago or some of the larger cities would have to be able to effectively measure. But we're getting there. So check back with me in a year after we've gone through one of our CIP budget processes, and maybe I can shed a little bit more light on some of that. And with that, I'll stop blabbering. You guys have been so incredibly patient, and we're 4 minutes over time. I apologize.
Thank you very much. You got a lot in there.